Today's episode is brought to you by Surfshark. Today, you do practically everything online, don't you? And your online privacy is paramount. So you can enjoy peace of mind knowing that your online privacy is improved and protected from hackers 24/7 by the award-winning Surfshark. How, you may ask? Well, their main product, VPN, basically acts as a shield, so when your device connects to the internet, all that information is, in a way, encrypted, so anyone who tries to snoop on you won't be able to see what you're doing or where you're doing it from. Everything that you do online stays private. Plus, if you use a VPN, you can virtually travel the world from the comfort of your own home, and Surfshark gives you more than 100 countries that you can choose from. Once you change your virtual location, you'll be able to bypass censorship and restrictions, find your favourites on Netflix or Hulu or Disney Plus or any other streaming services, and even access new libraries to watch even more content. Say, for example, you can't see a YouTube video because of your location. Use Surfshark VPN. Struggling to access that website to buy limited edition goods? Use Surfshark VPN. Simple. Try it today, totally risk-free, with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Secure your privacy with Surfshark. Enter coupon code TRUECRIMEPOD for an extra 3 months free at surfshark.deals/truecrimepod. Yes, 3 months free. That's surfshark.deals/truecrimepod. Hello all, and the very warmest of welcomes to the True Crime Enthusiast podcast, those slices of true crime that are often less familiar and a lot of the times forgotten tales, from the darkest depths of the UK and Ireland that I bring to you from my North Wales spare room. Doing so is myself, Paul, the creator, host and true crime enthusiast of the show's title. The hairy football, Peaksie, the true crime enthusiast cat, is here with me as ever. More active than usual today, so you may hear him, and we're completed by yourselves, the enthusiasts that each mean the world to me because you are, straight up, the heart of the show. It is as wonderful as always having you join us today. You get my thanks for doing so, and my express wishes that as you have, then it's for a tale that finds you and yours all good, all safe, and all well. So the tale I bring this time around then is a change from the episode I had planned to bring, which will now come perhaps next time, or I may even leave it for a few months yet, I'm undecided. And it was another case of a tale choosing itself, so much as it struck me with its sheer horror that it was always going to have to come here. Between the previous regular show episode, Neighbour from Hell, and the latest Patreon tale, Copycat, if you've heard it, and now this tale, you could be forgiven for thinking that a pattern is developing here. It isn't, as you've heard me say before, sometimes tales do just choose themselves. For it this time around, we're off back somewhere we visited several times before over the course of the show, the city of Manchester, and back to the leap year of 2016. The episode contains details and descriptions of crimes and events, involving descriptions of injury detail that some listeners may find disturbing and or distressing, so please use discretion whilst you're listening in all. Bearing that in mind, please join the True Crime Enthusiast for an episode I've entitled My Brother, My Killer. Our tale this time around takes place in the Newton Heath area of Manchester in southern Lancashire, about a mile and a half east of the city centre. Not too many stats this time around concerning it, but Newton Heath is notable for being the birthplace of the Newton Heath Lancashire and Yorkshire Railway Football Club, which was established in 1878 and later became Premier League team Manchester United. In 1943, the Mather and Platt stainless steel foundry there was forever immortalised in a painting by notable artist L.S. Lowry entitled Going to Work, And notable people to hail from there include Judy Finnegan, the long-suffering wife of the closest living thing to Alan Partridge that there is, Richard Madeley, and Coronation Street actor Michael Lavelle, who has played mechanic Kevin Webster for 41 years now. Probably the best thing that I can say about him. Back in 2016, Newton Heath's Surbiton Road, an unremarkable street of terraced houses akin to thousands upon thousands across the UK, was the home to then 49-year-old single mother Julie Archer, who lived at number 78 with two of her three grown-up children, Raoul and Kubila Cunningham Archer, who was known as Bibi. In what is commonplace for most of the people that we come to meet here on The Enthusiast, though beset by some troubles of her own, Julie was described as being a kind and warm woman. The words life and soul of the party, grounded, bubbly, spontaneous and humble being used more than once to recall her. Think someone who's very much loved and who's very family oriented, doting on her children and grandchildren. Monday the 29th of February 2016 should have been nothing but an ordinary day in Julie's household. Ahead of Bibi heading off to college later that morning, she and Bibi had breakfasted and then sat down on the sofa together with a cuppa in time to catch the latest pond life appearing on the screen on the then popular ITV talk show, for want of a better word, the Jeremy Kyle show, though Bibi had almost immediately headed upstairs to get ready for college. Bibi was later to describe how, over the sounds of her music playing, she had surely heard a knock at the door and had gone out onto the landing to see who the visitor was, thinking not too much of it when she saw who had called, hearing her mum address him as darling and resumed getting ready. The Jeremy Kyle show had been on for less than 15 minutes that morning, when just after 9:40 a.m, the lives of Julie, Bibi and several residents of Surbiton Road were to be changed forever. Bibi recalled to a court the following year, "I was playing music and drying my hair when, because I had no socks on, I suddenly felt the ground heat up and felt a shaking. I actually thought it was an earthquake at first and just carried on getting ready, but my dog wouldn't shut up crying at the door." Her dog had been anxious ever since the visitor had called. Bibi continued, "I suddenly smelt chemical smoke. I could then see smoke from where the doorway was and I knew there was a fire. I ran back into my mum's bedroom and called the police from there." Thinking then to get downstairs to her mum, when Bibi came out of the bedroom, she saw smoke blocking her way off, continuing, "There was no way out. It was either go down the stairs and get burnt or jump out of the window, so I decided to jump. While I was at the window deciding how to get out, I could see my neighbours telling me to jump, and then I could see my mum. She was naked and her face was red, her eyes were red and puffy-eyed, and her hair was all greasy. Her clothes had completely burnt off her. She was dragging herself up the driveway towards the gate. She couldn't walk, she was like lifting her arms out. I screamed and she turned and started to walk towards the front door again. I think she was trying to save me. I jumped from the window and neighbours came to help me." Tragically, Bibi's pet dog died in the fire. In her later police statement, neighbour Mandy Duffy provided a graphic account of this scene, describing it as like something from a horror movie. She told how her son Daniel had immediately raced out of the house to help the burning woman, but when this proved impossible, he turned his attention to rescuing Bibi, who was trapped 12 feet up in the upper floor of the house. She told the Manchester Evening News, "My daughter-in-law heard shouting and they saw the girl looking out the window. She's just 19 years old. My son ran out and the woman was already in the front garden on fire. Her injuries were horrific. There was just nothing he could do for her. He had to step around her so that he could help the girl, and she jumped out of the window into his arms. Whilst Daniel and another man caught Bibi, the other man then headed into the thick black smoke billowing from the property to see if anyone else was inside, whilst the horrifically injured Julie moaned, "My brother, my brother." However, he was driven back by the intensity of the blaze. Daniel Dussey recalled later, "I remember thinking the woman was beyond help." Another neighbour, who lived close to the scene of the incident, recalled shortly afterwards, "My daughter heard screaming at first. She said one girl jumped out of the bedroom window and someone else ran out on fire. She screamed, 'Get her a blanket!' and a woman ran out and put her house coat over her. I just saw the smoke. When I came out to look, I couldn't see any flames, just smoke. My grandson phoned the fire brigade and I rushed around here. If it's arson, then it's absolutely terrible. It made me feel sick. I thought right away there was something suspicious about it." Now, whilst researching and writing this, as I always do when I digest particular details or a certain scene from an account, I had quite a graphic and disturbing image of this in my mind, and it horrified and chilled me. My own imagination of it was bad enough, but whatever I can imagine, it must really pale into the reality of it. It must have been horrendous. In the moments before the horror, before the screaming started and the horrifically injured Julie managed to stagger out of the house, no one was to take any real heed of the figure cycling away from the scene, wearing a dark baseball cap and carrying a rucksack, although several home CCTV systems were to capture him. Bibi, thankfully, had only minor injuries, but Julie was only moments later airlifted to Withenshaw Hospital's specialist burns unit. At that time, mere minutes later, she already had horrific full-thickness burns to 70% of her body, which were later to increase to 95%. However, whilst Julie was being airlifted to hospital, before she'd been sedated and placed into an induced coma, she had dispelled any notion that this had been the result of some sort of horrific accident, as she had told both attending paramedics at the scene and hospital staff at Withenshaw exactly who had attacked her, saying, "He's done it. He's thrown it at me." When asked who had, Julie replied, "My brother Stephen. He's been threatening to kill me and my sister for the last 3 weeks since our dad died." Julie told another nurse that her brother was going to the toilet, and the next thing she knew, she was on fire. Yes, Julie had named her own elder brother, 50-year-old Stephen Archer, as being responsible for the horror that had befallen her, and indeed, Bibi was to confirm that the caller to the house that morning, mere moments before all hell broke loose, had been her uncle Stephen. Now, was this a woman speaking in delirium through shock and pain, or could really have her eldest sibling going in the face of supposing to love and protect you younger family members, really have done that to her? In what reality does that happen? Stephen Archer was the oldest of four children born to Alan Jeffrey Archer and his wife Wendy, having siblings Julie, Gillian, and another who is unnamed. The couple split when Stephen was very young, in the early 1970s, and at least Stephen and Julie were taken into care after this, largely growing up in the care system. Over the course of their childhood, Stephen and Julie didn't get along, and would often fight as children, as was described later. Now, it isn't recorded when they returned to their mother, though it is stated that all four children had little contact with their father while they were growing up. But what is recorded is that from a young age, Stephen showed signs of disturbed behaviour. There are tales of him showing an express interest in survivalism, sleeping rough and living off the land, and of the occult, which his sister Gillian was later to recall began around the mid-1970s when he was about 9 years old. Stephen's disturbed behaviour as he grew older led to him becoming the proverbial black sheep of the family and him having a somewhat strained relationship with them, though by no means was he excommunicated completely. Indeed, reports are that he spent time with them over the years and showed kindness to his nieces and nephews. But this disturbing behaviour prevailed, and eventually, in 2001, when he was 35 years old, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. It was an illness that ran in the family, as Julia herself was diagnosed with the very same condition, though whether this was before or after her brother was isn't reported. But while Julie largely managed her condition through prescribed medication, Stephen neglected to do this, and the paranoia that is an almost omnipresent symptom of this now began to exhibit itself more and more within him. One constant obsession of his were the conspiracy theories he held that police and lawyers were out to kill him, and another, perhaps more alarmingly, was that he obsessed over keeping Molotov cocktails at his home in the Openshaw district of Manchester for protection. His sister Gillian recalled. He had an obsession with petrol and petrol bombs, and there was once an incident when a gang of youths had attacked Stephen, and there was afterwards a smell of petrol at his home. I said to him, "Why can I smell petrol?" Stephen said, "Don't worry about them, I've got rid of them." I said, "What have you got petrol bombs for?" And he said, "In case them dickheads come back." For a father who was largely absent from their lives growing up, by the late 2000s, his children had begun having a relationship with him, perhaps in part due to his ailing health, as by 2015, Jeffrey had developed chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. However, his relationship with his eldest son was practically non-existent, following a series of rows on the times when they had met up. Jeffrey was also to have a stroke that year, and of his own express wish, following his release from hospital, in November 2015, he moved into the Brookdale View care home on Newton Heath's Avril Street so he could be cared for, visited there regularly by Julie and Gillian. Jeffrey Archer, unfortunate name that, like, also expressly instructed staff that he didn't want any contact with his eldest son. Gillian recalled later. Me and Julie would alternate and take food for him because he didn't like the food there as he was fussy. Stephen contacted me asking to go and see Dad, and I always tried to keep the peace, but he turned up there himself and Dad said he didn't want to see him. Stephen asked them to let him in, even if it was just for Dad to swear at him. He wanted to hear that himself. It was now that the obsession began to build in Stephen Archer. He posted a number of Facebook messages and statuses after his father had moved into the nursing home, in which he accused staff of bleeding their father dry, and voiced his suspicions about Julie Archer and her sister Gillian taking food into their father, that they were poisoning him and arranging it so he was cut out of any inheritance from his father's estate. He was even convinced that they had placed their father in the home against his will and would send emails and letters to the home alleging all sorts, as well as to the sisters. Gillian said later. Stephen imagined conspiracies against him. The police, doctors, even lawyers were trying to kill him, and he would try to prove his conspiracy theories right. He felt we were keeping him away from his father, even though that was Dad's choice. There was once a mix-up with Dad's bank account and Julie was unable to draw money out. But when Stephen heard about this, he thought the nursing home tried to steal money from my dad. He thought the home was trying to finish off our father. In one letter to the home, Archer had wrote of his sisters. If fate were to strike them down, I will be next of kin. Now on the 26th of January 2016, Archer's frail elderly father Geoffrey died in the care home of natural causes, complications stemming from the stroke he'd had the previous year. His will dictating he was leaving his money and his flat to Gillian and Julie, but Stephen Archer was given nothing. Just 11 days after Geoffrey's death, his brother David Russell Archer, who was known as Russell, also died, again of natural causes, but to the obsessive Archer, this only served to harden his delusions. He aired his suspicions in sinister Facebook messages claiming that the two deaths were no coincidence, and as well as making a number of allegations against both his sisters and the care home, Archer approached the coroner trying to have his father's cremation stopped, and on the 17th of February, even aired his suspicions to the police. Now his claims were looked into, but were found to be, of course, completely unsubstantiated, Gillian added. Stephen reacted badly after my dad's death, but his behaviour got a lot worse when Russell died. He was convinced me and my sister killed both of them, and he was writing all sorts of things on Facebook. I asked him to stop writing things, and I also texted him saying, "If anyone killed Dad, it's you stressing him." But Stephen was convinced that it was Julie who had put my dad in the home. In a series of text messages to Gillian that month, Archer had said, "Don't accuse me of murdering my dad when you and Julie are the key suspects taking food in. Don't bug me at this time of night. Jill, get your head down for fuck's sake, and let the toxicology rule out my suspicions. Justice will look after you." In a Facebook post to Julie, he wrote, "If fate was to strike you down, then I'll become next of kin. Be careful what you do regarding Dad's money and any paperwork that you sign." And another message to Gillian, 3 days before the fire, read, "My finger was at Julie, who I suspected was the one robbing him. I know we were close as kids. I looked after your kids as best I could, but I think something's corrupted you and you're scared of grassing. I don't like how they've both died on me like this. If my mam knows it was Julie, I hope she doesn't cover for her. She needs to do time. I still think you were drawn into the food game by Julie. You've been used by her so she can finish him off in there and hide all she took off him. Get one thing straight. I ain't ever going to make myself ill to eliminate my suspicions. If you want to expose anything, threaten to show up." Gillian added, "He blamed Julie more than me and was obsessed with proving that she was responsible for the deaths. He wanted Julie to be punished for what he thought she'd done by going to prison. Julie told me she was scared, but we were both scared because of Stephen's behaviour. To me, he was unstable, and I was worried what he was going to do." Gillian was right to worry, for when no one took his irrational beliefs seriously, his obsession boiled over, and that morning of the 29th of February 2016, Stephen Archer went to his sister's home in Newton Heath with an incendiary device. Petrol mixed with mineral spirit in a plastic Pepsi bottle. He threw the mixture of petrol and mineral spirits all over his younger sibling Julie as she sat on her sofa, then lit the vapours with his cigarette lighter, causing her to be engulfed in flames, before cycling away from the scene. Petrol mixed with mineral spirit will burn hotter and for much longer. Horror beyond belief, isn't it? It took 3 fire appliances to bring the resulting fire under control, and the air around Surbiton Road remained thick that morning with the smell of burnt UPVC. So fierce had the fire been that the frames and door of the property had been completely destroyed. There are pictures of the aftermath of the fire available online taken the following day when a fire investigation team had made the scene safe and confirmed that the fire had been started deliberately with the lethal sounding accelerant that I described a moment ago. And the devastation caused, well, it just serves to emphasize how horrific an action I am describing. In an unusual move, immediately after Julie had been airlifted to Withenshaw Hospital, though they didn't name her then, 51-year-old Stephen Archer was named as the primary person of interest police were after. And Detective Inspector Chris Flint of Greater Manchester Police told the gathered media that the domestic incident was being investigated as an attempted murder, saying, "This is a domestic-related incident, but the individuals concerned are not partners. The victim has suffered significant injuries. She has 70% burns, and her injuries are life-changing and potentially life-threatening. We are investigating this matter as attempted murder. Preliminary investigations show extensive damage to the property. The fire has been intense, and that is backed up by officer and witness testimony." D.I. Flint added it was understood that the suspect most likely had used petrol to start the fire and could still be armed with petrol. He said, "It is likely he has petrol bombs on him. We are working on the strong likelihood that a petrol bomb has been discharged on the address. From what we know about him and his obsession with petrol, it's likely he has petrol in some kind of container on him. We are also putting out an appeal to petrol stations that might have seen this person come in and purchased an amount of petrol. They possibly thought nothing of it, but we now think it's particularly relevant." D.I. Flint stressed that Archer was known to police and mental health services and added, "He is a particularly unstable individual and he is not to be approached in any circumstances. If he's sighted, please dial 999 immediately and let the emergency services do the rest." A police manhunt now began in earnest for Archer, one with an extra sense of urgency as, after learning of his obsession with petrol bombs and his paranoia that authority figures were conspiring against him, when officers had raided Archer's home in Victoria Street in nearby Openshaw, he was nowhere to be found. But what was a large quantity of highly flammable white spirit and an A4 pad upon which was written a bullet-pointed list, saying as follows. A. Unlucky knobheads. B. Hand your notice in, lol. C. I will be picking yous off. Ramblings of a delusional individual? Or, knowing police would be looking for him as a prime suspect, had Archer left them a chilling warning that he would next be targeting police officers? The senior officer leading the inquiry, Superintendent Arif Nawaz of Greater Manchester Police, said the following day, "First of all, our thoughts are with the victim and her family. This is a horrific incident and I cannot imagine what the victim is going through. We can assure the victim, the family and the wider public that we are doing everything we can to find the person responsible and bring them to justice. The victim is a family member of Stephen Archer. She is still in a very critical condition. It is touch and go and she is fighting for her life. Our specialist support officers are supporting the family through this extremely difficult time. We have a large multi-skilled team currently searching for Stephen Archer and we believe he may have links to Openshaw where he lives and the Marple and Romilly areas where we know he has connections. Our search, however, is not limited to those areas. We are appealing to those who work in petrol stations to be extra vigilant and call police if you think you see him. Stephen usually wears a baseball cap and carries a large rucksack. He's known to travel on a bicycle. We have reason to believe Stephen could be carrying several bottles of petrol in his backpack, and a man was seen fitting his description cycling away from the scene. We are appealing for the public to take a look at his picture and get in touch with us if you see him. Please do not approach Stephen, but contact police as a matter of urgency by calling 999. He then added, Stephen, if you should see this appeal, come and talk to the police. We can end this situation in a calm manner and find out what led to this tragic situation. Alongside pictures of Archer taken from his Facebook page, police indeed released several still clips from home camera CCTV at 9:53 a.m. in the area of Surbiton Road, showing a man with a baseball cap and backpack, thought to be Archer, who had fled the scene on a bicycle. Now incidentally, the time on at least one of these released stills must be wrong, as it depicts the figure cycling down Surbiton Road towards where it meets Edenbridge Road, but shows the time as 10:15 a.m, when Archer would have most likely been long gone from the scene. Or, had he indeed hung around the scene for another 30 minutes, basking in the commotion? As the hunt for him continued, and as Julie lay in an induced coma, fighting for her life, as I said, her burns having increased to 95%, there was a surreal development in the following days, because in the midst of the hunt for him, Archer made contact with his family. 3 days after the horrific attack, his mother Wendy received an envelope containing two cards that had been posted locally. One of them, though it would of course been the last thing on her mind to even occur to her, was a birthday card for her. Confirmed to have been sent by Stephen Archer, because his DNA was found on the postage stamp, the message inside the card read as follows. Ma'am, just to say I'm truly sorry for what I did to Julie, but believe she deserved it for what she did to my dad. She needs to confess, and so does Jill for her part, and you should be sorry for covering for Julie. I can't trust you unless you spill the beans on what's happened and what was meant to happen to me. I want you back before whoever is controlling you finishes me off. Love, Steve. 2 kisses. A footnote read, sorry, I can't put any money in this. I'm nearly skint. Unbelievable, that, eh? Barely keeping her emotions in check, Wendy Archer made a brief television appeal to her son following receiving this card, saying, Steve, I've got your card. I want you to know that no one is controlling me, and no one is forcing me to send this message to you. I know you think I'm covering things up, but I'm not. I do not want any harm to come to you. Will you please contact the police? Now I said there were two cards in the envelope, didn't I? The second card, callously, was a Get Well Soon card addressed to Julie. In it, Archer had written, his obsession and paranoia prevalent. Karma has punished you through me. I couldn't kill you and never will, but I can't forgive you for what you did to my dad and uncle. Tell the truth, who was behind it? Was it a secret deal to stitch me up for it? Come on, girl, please. Steve. The message was next to a printed Bible verse, which read, I'll strengthen you, I'll help you. No words whatsoever. No words. 4 days after the attack, after being given the news by doctors who had fought to stabilise her that Julie may never recover from her coma, at the very least, if she did, being left severely debilitated and requiring round-the-clock care, her family made the heartbreaking decision to turn off the life support machine, and on the evening of Thursday the 3rd of March, Julie passed away. Police were now hunting a confirmed killer. The following morning, an off-duty police officer and his girlfriend had just alighted a train at Marple railway station, near the town of Stockport, When the sharp-eyed officer spotted an individual getting onto the same train, an individual that matched the widely circulated photograph and description of Stephen Archer, and who had purchased a ticket to New Mill Central Station, which is a couple of stops further along the line. Immediately alerting the incident room, at 11:30 a.m, several unmarked police cars pulled up in the vicinity of New Mill Station, and as luck would have it, spotted their suspect walking past the Midland pub on Brabin's Brow, about 60 metres from the train station. Several armed plainclothes officers then pounced on their wanted man, bringing him down in the snow. As he was about to be detained, Archer, it was of course he, pulled a plastic bottle filled with liquid from his backpack and, whilst attempting to unscrew the cap, moved a lighter towards it, but was overpowered by officers who used a fire extinguisher. Once Archer had been secured, it was found to be a homemade incendiary device similar to the one that had been used to kill Julie. He had two more of these in his backpack, along with quantities of lemon juice and bicarb. Witness Dougie Pantin was walking towards the nearby Midland pub when he witnessed the police swoop and described the dramatic scenes, recalling later. "This man walked towards me. He was dressed in dark clothing, had his hood up and a rucksack. He looked at me, there was eye contact, and then he looked straight ahead. I thought to myself, that was a bit strange. Then a car drove up and onto the pavement and blocked him against the stone wall. Then a van passed with the doors open. Men jumped out and they pulled the man I'd passed down. They were shouting at him, 'Down, down, down.' I think I saw one threaten him with a taser, but I didn't see it being used. The men from the vehicles were in plain clothes, but one had a black cap with a checked band round it. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. One of the officers just told me to go, so I went to the Midland to chill out. I was shaking, to be honest. I wondered after if it was the man the police have been looking for." Another eyewitness, David Robotham, told the MEN, "The man was walking down Brabin's Brow when a police car went straight up to the wall and he jumped up and sat on the wall. No sooner had he jumped up than a van came up Brabin's Brow towards them. Another BMW police car came in front of me. One officer came up with a taser and grabbed the man by the shoulder, and two or three officers got him to the ground." Now, I think for a suspect who intelligence said was very likely to have petrol on him, then a taser probably wouldn't have been used. As Archer was being led to a police van, he's reported to have said to officers, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to kill her, I just wanted to maim her." It's not much less evil, that, is it? In custody, Archer gave nothing but no comment responses in interviews, and when told he was being charged, firstly with arson with intent to endanger life, referring to his niece, Bibi, Archer replied, "I deny that charge." Charged with the murder of his sister Julie, he said, once again, "I will be denying the murder charge. I had no intention to kill my sister, just to maim her." A further charge of four separate offences of possessing extreme pornographic images, including 16 of adults having intercourse with animals, was added to the indictment, though this charge was later not proceeded with. The mind boggles, doesn't it? Stephen Archer appeared before Manchester magistrates on Monday the 7th of March, and the following day appeared at Manchester Crown Court, where he was remanded in custody to await trial on charges of murder and arson with intent to endanger life. A provisional trial date was set for September of that year. By the same day Archer appeared before magistrates, a friend of Julie's who had known her for 45 years, Karen Wakefield, paid tribute to Julie in an emotional statement when she reminisced about the pair growing up together. She told the MEN, "She was a big part of my life growing up, we used to stay over at each other's houses, and we brought out the rebel in each other. We hung out together till we were 16, then we lost touch. Karen explained how they then met up again many years later when Julie popped into the wishy-washy laundrette that Karen ran, saying, "We planned to meet up. She was the first on my list for my 50th birthday this year. This is never going to be now. I was told she wasn't going to make it, so I asked her sister to go and whisper this to her. Karen said she loves you, mate. She will treasure all our childhood memories. You'll always be in her heart and to have a safe journey. I am gutted for all her family, especially her children. Julie was a massive part of my life. She will always be in my heart, and I'm so grateful I managed to see her and have a big hug." In a Facebook post later that day, Karen added, "Words cannot express how upset I am to hear my friend has passed away. I will treasure our childhood memories forever, and I'm thankful you came to surprise me. I never expected it would be our last hug. Sleep tight, mate." Karen had, on the day following Julie's death, created a Just Giving page in Julie's memory to raise funds for the Withenshaw Burns unit that had done their best to care for her, a message on the page reading, "As many of you may have seen in the news, sadly, yesterday evening Julie passed away. All of the support of friends and family hasn't gone unnoticed, and it is very much appreciated. This has been a really hard week for all the family, and now she can be at peace, we would love to donate money to the family and Withenshaw Hospital Burns Unit." Before the end of that same day, more than £400 had been raised. Though the page is closed now, it ultimately raised £1,023 in donations from friends and general well-wishers, touched by Julie's tragic story, and several of whom left their own reminiscences about her in the comments section. Stephen Archer did indeed come to trial at Manchester Crown Court on the 9th of September of that year, but 3 days into the hearing, the jury was discharged after Archer dismissed his own legal counsel, and a new hearing was ordered for the following March. At the same court then, on Monday the 20th of March 2017, he appeared to face the same charges before our favourite judge here on The Enthusiast, Mr Justice Sir Peter Openshaw. We've come across him many times before as a presiding judge in cases featured on the show. And those of you with a good memory will recall that he is the son of murdered judge William Harrison Openshaw, whose case I covered several years ago, way back in series 4 of the show, in the episode The Judge and the Grudge, and quite a remarkable story that one is too. If you've not heard it, it's in the back catalogue, go and have a listen and you'll see what I mean. Archer issued pleas of not guilty to both charges he faced, though it was reported that in a letter written to an employee of Eastlands Housing whilst he was on remand, Archer was alleged to have stated an intention to plead not guilty to murder on the grounds of diminished responsibility. However, prosecuting counsel Mark Kellett Casey told the court that Archer had produced no evidence at all of a mental condition. Now, I don't know if this is incorrect reporting or not, or just another glimpse into the strange character of Stephen Archer. For this is someone who, by that time, had for 16 years been diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. So, this suggested line of defence would have been heavily supported by this, you would have thought, wouldn't you? However, it was also reported that following being charged, Archer had written to the CPS claiming that Julie's death was as a result of a tragic accident, outlaying a story to support this claim that I shall come on to shortly. Mr. Kellett, opening the prosecution's case, told the court, "This is a case where death was caused by the deliberate ignition of petrol mixed with mineral spirit in the sitting room of this house. In short, the Crown say on the morning of February the 29th, Stephen Archer arrived at the home of Julie, armed with a Pepsi bottle that contained a mixture of aggressively flammable liquid. Gillian Archer will tell you Stephen had a long-standing obsession with petrol bombs and told her he kept them in his flat for his own protection. There, Julie was sat on a two-seater sofa in her living room and the defendant emptied the bottle of flammable liquid over her, petrol mixed with mineral spirit, and lit a naked flame that caused the vapour to ignite, setting fire to Julie and the house. When mixed with petrol, mineral spirit makes the petrol burn longer and hotter than it otherwise would. There was a large impact from the resulting explosion, with the walls and floor shaking, and Bibi went onto the landing and saw thick black smoke coming from the lounge. Fortunately, Bibi was able to escape by jumping from an upstairs window, and despite being extremely distressed, she suffered only minor injuries. In setting fire to Julie, the Crown say the defendant must have intended to cause, at the very least, really serious harm to, if not to kill, his sister. He knew Julie's daughter was upstairs, and the Crown say, knowing that Bibi was present in the house, he must have intended to endanger her life by starting the fire downstairs. As a result of the fire, Julie suffered frankly horrific injuries with burns to 95% of her body. Neighbours described the horrendous nature of Julie's injuries like something from a horror movie. One describes how her clothes had melted, leaving an imprint on her skin. Both described how the skin was dripping from her body. Despite being taken to hospital by helicopter, she died 3 days later on March the 3rd as a direct result of the injuries. The actions of the defendant are a result of growing hostility towards his sisters, Gillian and Julie, resulting from the death of their father, Jeffrey. Mr. Kellett then showed jurors pictures of the devastation of the aftermath of the fire, pictures of the defendant's home, some of the evidence in exhibit form, including a blackened Pepsi bottle that had held the accelerant and that had been recovered from the dining room of Julie's home, and then proceeded to tell the court the sequence of events leading up to the attack, as I brought to you earlier. Archer, hearing the evidence outlined against him, smiled and shook his head in the dock. Giving evidence at Manchester Crown Court, Bibi told the hearing that her mother had been grieving following the deaths of her father and uncle, but on the morning of February 29th the previous year, both mother and daughter had been happy and smiling. "I remember it being a good day for us," she said. Bibi said she was getting ready for college that morning when there was a knock at the door. Her mother got up to answer the door and shouted up to her, "It's your uncle Stephen." Bibi continued that Stephen Archer looked up and saw her as he entered the house, hearing her mother calling him darling. Zafar Ali Casey, defending Archer, put it to Bibi, "He was always nice and kind to you, wasn't he?" "Not always," she replied. She had told police that her uncle Stephen had previously bought her gifts, including a laptop and an MP3 player, and had acted like a proper family man, as she described. But she also said she knew at this time that, I quote, "Stephen was angry with my auntie and my mum," continuing, "I wasn't comfortable with Stephen's mental state. Because there'd been arguments before, I'm coming to the stairs to see if she was all right. He came in and she was like, 'Come in, darling.' After that, I thought, maybe they're going to sort it out," she said. But she added, "I never imagined him doing anything like this." When Archer came to the door, her mother didn't sound aggressive or violent. Neither did Stephen, to be fair, Bibi confirmed. "You saw him, but you can't be sure he saw you," Mr. Ali said. "We made eye contact, and he knows I live with my mum, so that's false," Bibi replied. Bibi also disagreed with the suggestion that she was mistaken when she said she saw Archer carrying a backpack into the house. Mr. Ali then brought up an incident that had occurred at the start of February 2016, suggesting that during an argument, Julie Archer had threatened her daughter with a meat cleaver. "Your mother grabbed a meat cleaver from the kitchen and threatened you with it. She pointed it at me as she was talking," Bibi said. "She told you to get out of the house and not to come back. She was angry when she said that. I think it was a spur of the moment thing. You must have worried she was going to hurt you. If she was going to hurt me, she would have done. She was a very determined person. I was anxious because of the shouting. You were so worried you told your student support worker. I can't remember what I said, but I remember going into college crying. You told her your mother went to hit you and you had to push her away. I don't remember saying that, but I remember from the incident I pushed her back down to the chair. You told the social worker your mother pulled your hair. You had to stay with your aunt for a few days and were advised by college authorities to call the police. You told the social worker this is how your mother copes under pressure and that she was having anger bursts. Because she was grieving, anger is a stage of grieving, so it would make sense if I'd said that." Mr. Ali then claimed that in 2015, Bibi had said her mother had been abusing her mentally and physically. "I don't remember saying that at all. If I said it, it must have been a spur of the moment thing. I was a kid," Bibi said. Mr. Ali then suggested that in early 2016, Bibi had contacted the health centre about her mother's mental health. Bibi, who had told the court her mother was a paranoid schizophrenic, said that she couldn't remember doing so. Now, there is a reason for this aggressive line of questioning, however, as it stemmed from this news story that Archer had written to the CPS about whilst he was on remand, professing Julie's death was as a result of a freak accident. Archer suggested here that Julie had set fire to herself, or in his words, self-immolated, the jury was told. Archer now claimed that on February 29th of the previous year, he went to his sister's house while affected by drinking sherry and lager. He said that he told Julie that he suspected she had poisoned their father and uncle and questioned her about this. He said he saw a small blade in her hand, and in order to frighten her into answering his questions, Archer claimed he had poured half a litre of petrol into a glass which he had placed on the stairs by the front door. He said while he continued to question her, she had first stuck two fingers up at him and then jabbed at him with a clenched fist. Feeling frightened that she was about to attack with what he believed to be the blade in her hand, he said he grabbed the glass of petrol and threw the contents of the glass from 6 feet away all over Julie. Mr. Kellett said of Archer's account, "It was only at this point he realised Julie was attempting to light a cigarette. He suggested, for the first time, that his sister Julie Archer set fire to herself, or in his words, self-immolated. Archer said that when on fire, Julie then swore at him to leave, and that once outside, he sought to get back in to help her, but he then heard the sound of drawers banging, and suspecting that Julie was arming herself due to her violent nature, panicked and instead cycled away." Yes, straight up, that is the new story, Archer claimed. The claims of a freak accident and acting in self-defence were him changing his account to fit the evidence, said Mr. Kellett. Archer stuck to this story when he gave evidence himself, though. He claimed he had petrol with him merely as protection and had tipped it over his sister in self-defence after she taunted him with a blade, catching fire in this freak accident because she was lighting a cigarette simultaneously. Giving evidence in his defence, he told jurors, She told me she'd stopped smoking 2 years ago. I had no idea this was going to happen. I was fearing for my life. I had to get on my bike and get the hell out of there because I know what she's like with a knife. After he left the street, Archer said he was crippled with regard to getting her help from emergency services because he didn't know Julie's address. He told the jury, "Don't forget, I'm drunk going through all of this. When I was forced to abandon her, she had at least 25% survivable burns. If I wanted to kill my sister, burn her to death, I'd have tied her up and locked her in the house. I'd have come by night avoiding the CCTV and all the witnesses. There's no way I intended to burn her to death like that. If I wanted to murder my sister, I'd have stabbed her to death." He really does sound delightful, doesn't he? Later, when it was put to him that he had tipped the petrol into her lap using a pint glass, intending to thoroughly douse her, he said, "I'd say tipping it over her head would be more effective." What a testimony that must have been to hear, eh? Horrendous. When it was put to Archer that he hadn't mentioned acting in self-defence until months after the incident, he said, "I can't remember when I first decided or mentioned it because I was going to admit to manslaughter because what happened was so unbelievable." What an obscene account. I think you'll find it's your bollocks story that is unbelievable, Archer. In his closing address, Mr. Kelly told the court, "In terms of what you make of any suggestion Julie Archer has deliberately self-harmed or committed suicide to burn herself in her own home with her daughter upstairs, bear in mind evidence from Beebe about Julie's desperate attempts, regardless of her horrific injuries, to get back into the house to save her, to help her. Bear in mind how that fits in with the notes. The Crown say the defendant is guilty of murder. He had a long-standing obsession with petrol bombs. Consider what you will about his conduct on arrest. When in possession of 3 petrol bombs, he seemed to respond to being confronted by attempting to set fire to one. Consider who it was who ignited the mixture. The Crown must make you sure it was Stephen Archer, that this was no accidental ignition by Julie, as he now seems to suggest. This could not have been caused by exposure to a lit cigarette. A lit cigarette does not contain enough energy to ignite the vapour. The Crown suggest once you've determined the central issues, who poured the mixture and who ignited it, the other issues in terms of his intention fall into place. In igniting the vapour, he must have intended, if not to kill Julie Archer, to cause a really serious harm. He must have intended to endanger the life of Beebe, who he knew was upstairs, for what other intention could he have had? The Crown say he is guilty of murder." On the 30th of March 2017, Archer showed no emotion as he was convicted of murder, though he shook his head in disbelief after jurors took 3 hours and 23 minutes to reach a majority 10-1 verdict to a cry of yes from Julie's family members in the public gallery. Her son Raoul had attended every day of the trial. Archer was, however, acquitted of the second charge of arson with intent to endanger the life of Beebe. Sentencing was adjourned until the following day, and when he then reappeared before Mr. Justice Openshaw, said nothing as the judge remarked it was likely that when he did not extract from Julie the false confession he wanted, he decided to punish her for what he believed she had done to their father, before leaving without making the slightest attempt to save her or raise the alarm. The judge continued, "This was a dreadful murder and an act of extreme wickedness. After developing beliefs which became obsessional, he armed himself with a bottle of petrol added with mineral spirits, causing it to burn longer and with more intensity, and cause further suffering. He must somehow have gained the knowledge that adding mineral spirit to petrol causes it to burn longer and with greater intensity, so a fire would cause more burns and greater suffering. To add mineral spirit as he did was, as it seems to me, an act of extreme wickedness. Whether he decided to punish her for what he thought she did will never be known, but I'm sure that by throwing it over her, he deliberately ignited the petrol. She was immediately in flames, and he made no effort to help. Instead, he made off on his cycle. He has shown not the slightest regret or remorse for what he has done. Sentencing Archer to life imprisonment, Mr. Justice Openshaw ordered him to serve a minimum of 27 years before his release could be considered, meaning that Archer cannot ask for parole until 2043 at the earliest, when he will be 79 years old, though he was warned that he may never be freed. He was then taken away to begin this sentence. Following the verdict, in a statement released through police, Mrs. Archer's children said, "Mum was funny and outgoing. She was always smiling and loved to make people laugh and was the life and soul of the party. She was a lovely mum and grandma. She was nurturing and she always put everyone else first. The smallest thing meant the world to Mum, and she was always able to make the best of a bad situation. We will miss our Mum so much, but she will always be in our hearts." You can never imagine such loss in such horrific circumstances, can you? In a statement, Kirsty Walls of the Crown Prosecution Service said, "This is a tragic case in which Stephen Archer killed his sister only a matter of weeks after two other family members had sadly passed away. Evidence presented at the trial showed how he had posted abusive messages on social media, implying that his sisters had killed their father and uncle, and he made threats against them, messages that he later deleted. After making initial comments to the police that he had intended to maim his sister, he then claimed he had been acting in self-defense when he threw a glass of petrol at her, and that the ignition of the petrol had been a freak accident. However, after today carefully considering the evidence against him, the jury has accepted the prosecution case and found him guilty of murder. Not only did he kill Julie, he did so in a way that would cause a phenomenal amount of pain and suffering. Today, he begins a life sentence for this terrible crime. Archer is a dangerous man who has broken his whole family apart. He will now spend the next 27 years in prison and will have plenty of time to contemplate exactly what he did. I would like to offer my sincere condolences to the remaining members of the Archer family and their friends. Our thoughts are very much with them at this time." In the September following his conviction, the MEN reported that Archer had launched a bid to overturn his conviction and sentence and had given his counsel permission to pursue an appeal. The MEN reported in September 2017 that it had seen a press and media statement penned by Archer, a letter which was intended to be read on his behalf by his lawyer and which repeated his claim that victim Julie Archer had died in an accident in February of the previous year. Now, it's unlikely that Archer's claim about what happened that morning would have any bearing on any future appeal, but his mental state could, as Archer's Manchester Crown Court sentencing heard that while he believed himself to be perfectly well, as I said, he had been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia several years before. It wasn't thought likely that they would argue that the killing of his sister resulted from self-defense, as he continued to claim, but that his mental health would be at the center of their argument, claiming that the law doesn't cater properly for defendants who, even though they understand the legal process, are otherwise delusional. During Archer's sentencing hearing, his barrister, Zafar Ali, had said, "There's evidence in this case of a mental disability. Mr. Archer was born into a family with a history of mental illness. Records show as far back as 2001 he was admitted to a psychiatric hospital. There's a likelihood that Mr. Archer had been mentally ill for a significant period before 2001, but had never come into contact with psychiatric services. He was prescribed olanzapine, but never took it because he didn't consider himself to be mentally ill. When I first met Mr. Archer, I had real concerns about his fitness to plead. Mr. Archer maintains to this day that he is perfectly well and has no mental disability. One of the symptoms of schizophrenia, of course, can be lack of insight. Now in the letter, Archer continues to maintain his innocence, putting a new spin on the defence that was rejected by the jury, but retracting the claim he made in his trial that he threw petrol on his sister because he felt threatened by a blade she held in her hand. Instead, he now claimed that while he did make the drunken misinterpretation that his sister had a blade in her hand, he laughed at the size of it. The letter reads, "Mr. Archer has very recently admitted to me that he did not feel threatened by the blade in his sister's hand, which we now believe turned out to be the lighter that ultimately killed her. He in fact laughed at the size of the misinterpreted blade, which we now assume to have been the metal collar of that lighter, a drunken misinterpretation anyone could have made. He wasn't scared, she was just mimicking, trying to get him going. The real self-defense issue was his inability to get back into the house to help his sister due to the potential psychotic state she appeared to have become engaged in due to her aggressive and evasive attitude, which was the brunt cause of this horrific freak accident. As has just been proven, he was genuinely oblivious to the fact his niece was in the house. He had no harmful intent whatsoever towards her, and never has. We will be appealing against the conviction of murder and uncovering more evidence relating to this case, which we believe the Crown Prosecution Service have unlawfully extracted and failed to obtain. My most grateful thanks go to all those who have contributed to our defence. Thank you." It's quite a letter that, isn't it? However, as of today, there are no reports as to any further hearing or appeal, and so perhaps this account as an avenue of appeal has been abandoned. Stephen Archer remains a serving prisoner to this day. I came across this case purely by chance while I was researching another one. It wasn't a familiar tale to me at all, and it jumped for inclusion this series because I was struck by the barbarity of such a crime and the complexity of an individual such as Stephen Archer, for how much hatred must a person have in them to do something like this to another person, knowing that such a concoction will, at the very least, maim further than purely just petrol would. To create such a Molotov cocktail and having that in mind is bad enough, but then the target being your own sister. Despite the court deciding he was able to plea, and his refusal to enter a diminished responsibility plea, these have to be the actions of a madman, surely. I do believe that so filled with hatred was Archer that it sent him properly over the edge that February. And I also feel that Archer could have copped for a secure hospital order had he pleaded such, and with such an utter bollocks sounding story that he came out with about this being an accident, how on earth did he ever think such a story was going to go for him? Take into account also the cards that he sent whilst being hunted. He's there admitting his guilt, and the signs of disturbance and paranoia shine through with them. From him even taking the time out to obtain, write and post such cards, I mean, how many fugitives remember their mum's birthday? And even apologising to his mother in hers for not having placed any cash in it, just as matter of fact as that. Yet, so callous as to send his victim a get well soon card, surely knowing that she would have little chance of survival after his actions. And then, not offering a shred of remorse or apology towards her, instead solely focused on this misplaced paranoia against her that he was consumed with. And what would his end game have been? Would he have carried out the scrawl threats police found on the notepad in his home? I certainly think he would have done. After all, he had several similar sounding Molotov cocktails in his rucksack when arrested. And if you do that once, as determined and cold-blooded as he did, horrifically, then it must only get easier to do. Thankfully, Archer was caught when he was, for I believe that his sister Gillian had a very lucky escape, as did perhaps several police officers whose prompt action in taking Archer down saved them from being injured or perhaps even killed. Due to his actions of that February morning, Archer has left a family torn apart, family members left with pure memories, and a woman who today, so many years later, must still live with such a horrific, disturbing scene as I described, watching her burning mother attempting to save her. It chilled and sickened me picturing it as I was researching and writing, as I'm sure it has you, so imagine what it must have done to Bibi. You can't even, can you? Monstrous actions. Please take thoughts of Julie and her family away from this tale first and foremost, though, and not those of her evil brother. This episode is dedicated to her and them. I would love, as always, hearing any feedback or thoughts that you may have concerning the tale I've brought you here in My Brother, My Killer. Which, as ever, you can do so in the episode thread now up in the show's Facebook discussion group, or by getting in touch through any of the show's social media links. I'm always happy to chat wherever, I don't mind at all, should you want to. With that, I shall wrap up here now then, and time to pull the next tale out of the proverbial bag that will be coming to your ears soonest. All that remains for me to say is that I've been, I still am, and hopefully still will be Paul, the true crime enthusiast. Wishing you all good and safe times, and I shall speak to you very soon. Take care all, thanks very much for joining me in the Mog. Stay safe, and goodbye for now.